Welcome, curious minds, to another exhilarating deep dive. Today, we're not just dipping our toes, we're plunging headfirst into the mind-bending world of Claude Lévi-Strauss and his groundbreaking work, Structural Anthropology. Our mission today really is to decode these hidden grammars that shape human thought and culture. We're going to try and pull back the curtain on all the apparent chaos of human diversity to reveal the universal underlying structures that will connect us all. It's sort of like finding the secret blueprint for how humans build societies and make sense of the world, no matter where or when they live. Now, for this deep dive, you shared some really fascinating sources, including these texts with the Gujarati titles. It's so fast, Ricker, about serving him a lot about what's done. And for how he... Agamhi knows this, in a Yule.
I'm sorry. No, Nelvi and the Strav, third. A third. You Nelvia, Oren Mill. Han of Theoskop, though, and then he says, why see you get last net three, real chick guy up, Pajay Pai Boyo three, go get the winter. Go get the winter.
And these translate roughly to structural anthropology, the hidden rules of human thought, and structural anthropology, the secret maps of culture. So they give us this really rich, multifaceted lens to explore Lévi-Strauss's ideas.
And this whole deep dive, it really centers on a fundamental question that Lévi-Strauss was passionately pursuing. Are there universal laws? You know, laws governing human thought and social life that are maybe analogous to the laws of nature we see in physics or biology?
That's a huge question.
It is. And what comes through so clearly from his work is his firm conviction that the answer is, well, yes. And this isn't just some academic exercise, you know. It's a profound challenge to pure cultural relativism.
Right. The idea that anything goes, culturally speaking.
Exactly. He was aiming to uncover these invariant shared properties of the human mind itself. It fundamentally changes how we think about what it means to be human and how we're all connected beneath those surface differences.
Okay, so let's unpack this incredible architect of thought. Claude Lévi-Strauss lived from 1908 to 2009, a French anthropologist, ethnologist, widely seen as the father of modern anthropology and, well, the whole structuralist movement. Imagine this brilliant mind, right? Trained initially in philosophy and law, steeped in those Parisian intellectual traditions.
Mm-hmm. Very rigorous background.
But then, instead of just staying in academia, he decides to embark on this extensive fieldwork. He goes to the Amazon in the 1930s, living among indigenous communities in Brazil.
Which must have been quite a shift.
Absolutely. And this wasn't just some quick trip, you know. This immersive experience was completely foundational. It didn't just form the basis for his famous philosophical memoir, Triste Tropique, but it fundamentally shaped his entire perspective, bridging that abstract philosophical thinking with, well, deeply human experience.
And what made his perspective so distinctive was exactly that blend. The rigorous analytical precision you get from French philosophy, meeting the raw empirical data from deep ethnographic fieldwork.
That combination.
Right. But the really crucial influence, the absolute game changer, was his deep engagement with structural linguistics, especially the revolutionary work of people like Ferdinand de Saussure and Roman Jakobson.
Okay, linguistics. How did that connect?
Well, he studied how linguistic meaning doesn't come from individual sounds alone, right? It comes from the relationships and the oppositions between sounds within the whole system, like P versus B.
The structure.
Exactly.
Right.
His genius was realizing that this model, this insight into how language works, could be applied to things that aren't language, like kinship systems or the structure of myths or ritual patterns.
Oh.
This just revolutionized the field. It suggested that culture, much like language, has its own hidden grammar, a system of rules and relations that we can actually decipher to understand its deeper meaning. It's like realizing everything, social interactions, stories, traditions, is built on a kind of universal code.
And that brings us straight to the core idea in structural anthropology, doesn't it? The central argument that all this endless, dazzling diversity we see in human cultures, the myths, the social systems, it's not just random.
Not at all.
Lévi-Strauss argues they're all just surface manifestations, different expressions of these universal underlying structures of the human mind, different ways of expressing the same deep logic.
Precisely. And these deep structures, as he called them, they operate largely unconsciously. We're not typically aware of them. It's like you don't consciously think about grammatical rules when you speak, right?
Right, you just speak.
Their fundamentally relational meaning comes from connections within a system, not isolated bits. And crucially, they often get organized around binary oppositions.
Things like
nature versus culture, the raw versus the cooked, life versus death, these fundamental pairs. Levi-Strauss proposed that the anthropologist's real job isn't just describing cultures in detail. It's decoding these hidden grammars that govern them all, revealing that shared mental scaffolding underneath.
So the book itself, Structural Anthropology, it's a collection of his key essays, really, kind of a manifesto for this structuralist method.
That's a good way to put it.
And while maybe it was written mainly for academics, the ideas have just permeated everywhere in the humanities, haven't they? Changing how we study literature, psychology, everything.
Absolutely.
It basically tells us that cultural stuff, customs, traditions, they aren't just isolated things. They're elements in a much larger system of meaning, a kind of language, really, whose rules Levi-Strauss believed could absolutely be figured out, understood, and even compared across totally different societies. Okay, now this is where it gets really fascinating. Let's dive into some concrete examples of this method in action. How about we start with something really foundational, something that seems almost universal? The incest taboo and kinship.
Good place to start.
Most people just see the incest taboo as a basic don't, right? A prohibition. But Levi-Strauss, he saw something much deeper, didn't he? What was his revolutionary take?
It really is a powerful reframing.
Yeah.
Most see it as don't marry close family. Simple prohibition. But Levi-Strauss argued it's less about what you can't do and much more about a positive injunction. A requirement.
A requirement? How so?
Well, because you cannot marry your close kin, your sister, your daughter. You're essentially compelled to give them to another group in marriage.
Exchange.
Exactly. This act of giving and receiving, this exchange specifically of women between families in his initial formulation, is what creates alliances. It forges a social fabric beyond just your immediate family. It's the fundamental building block of society itself, marking that crucial transition from just nature, biology, to structured culture.
So it forces connection.
Precisely. He even boiled down the smallest possible family structure to what he called the atom of kinship. That's a brother, his sister, the sister's husband, and their child. That little unit, he argued, captures the essence of social alliance created through this exchange.
So if I'm getting this right, it's not just about forbidding something bad. It's about actively forcing connection and, by doing that, creating society itself. You called it the supreme rule of the gift.
That's the idea.
How does this deep rule, this principle of exchange, still shape our societies, even if we don't consciously think about it or practice it literally anymore? I mean, the idea of forming alliances, social networks through various kinds of exchange, that still feels very relevant.
Oh, absolutely. Even in modern life, that underlying principle of reciprocity, of giving and receiving to build and maintain relationships, it's still incredibly powerful. Think about how we build social capital or create professional networks.
Or even just exchanging gifts at holidays or weddings.
Exactly. It's all about establishing and reinforcing those bonds of reciprocity. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other simple social rules might be masking these really complex foundational mechanisms for group cohesion, even in our own lives today? It's like an unwritten contract. And that same logic, that structural thinking, extends right into how societies organize themselves. Levi-Strauss talked about dual organizations. He saw that whole villages or tribes were often divided into two complementary halves. Moieties, they're called.
Two halves, like teams.
Sort of, but they're deeply interconnected. They exist in these profound relationships of opposition and reciprocity. For example, one half might be responsible for burying the dead of the other half.
Oh, wow.
Or they might engage in specific ritual exchanges. They basically define each other through these complementary roles. They need each other.
So these dual organizations, could that be a direct manifestation of the mind's natural tendency to think in binary oppositions? You know, like we instinctively categorize things day, night, hot, cold, ustum.
And that's exactly how he saw it.
It's fascinating to think a physical division in a village could mirror such a deep cognitive pattern, like a social map of how our brains work. Now, Levi-Strauss also completely turned our understanding of myths upside down, didn't he? We used to think of them as just primitive fantasies, maybe irrational stories. How did he redefine what myths are actually doing?
He really did flip that idea. He argued myths are absolutely not irrational or primitive. They are sophisticated philosophical tools, a form of what he called savage thought or pensée sauvage.
Savage thought?
Yeah, but he didn't mean savage as in primitive. He meant it more like untamed or wild thought operating with a powerful logic, which isn't necessarily the logic of Western science. Their real function, he said, is to address fundamental, often irresolvable contradictions in human experience.
Like what kind of contradictions?
Think about life versus death, nature versus culture, being an individual versus being part of a group. Myths don't necessarily solve these contradictions in a neat, logical way. Instead, they provide a kind of logical model for mediating them, for making sense of them, allowing us to live with these built-in tensions. His analysis of the Oedipus myth is a classic example. He breaks it down into its smallest meaningful units. He called them mythemes.
Mythemes, like phonemes in language.
Exactly the same principle.
Yeah.
Units like Oedipus kills his father, or Oedipus marries his mother, or even things related to walking difficulty, like swollen feet or lameness. By arranging these mythemes, he showed how the myth works to mediate this deep conflict between autochthony, the idea that humans somehow originated directly from the earth.
Born from the soil.
Right.
Yeah.
Often affirming ties to the land and the undeniable biological reality of being born from two parents. The myth grapples with these profound paradoxes about where we come from and who we are.
And it wasn't just Greek myths. You mentioned another amazing example from the sources, the Kuna childbirth chant from Panama.
Yes, that's a fascinating case. Here, a shaman assists during a difficult childbirth, not with physical intervention, but by chanting this intricate myth. It provides a symbolic map, a language, really, for the woman experiencing intense pain.
So the myth helps structure the pain.
Precisely. It gives a symbolic framework, meaning, and structure to what might otherwise be just overwhelming, chaotic sensation. It lets the mother mentally move from that raw, unmanageable feeling into a symbolic order, which can have a remarkable psychosomatic healing effect. It really shows the power of shared belief and narrative to shape our subjective reality.
It really makes you question the line between belief and, well, physical effect.
It does. And we see this dynamic again in the story of Quetzalcoatl. This Krakayutl man initially set out to debunk shamanism, expose it as fake.
Oh, interesting.
But through his experiences, observing cures and even performing them himself, he ended up becoming a renowned shaman. He realized that the magic works not necessarily physical means, but through a shared social and psychological consensus.
What Levi Strauss called the shamanistic complex.
Exactly. It needs three things.
Yeah.
The sorcerer believing in his own power, the patient believing in that power, and crucially, the wider community believing in the ritual's effectiveness. It's the shared symbolic system that makes it real and effective within that group, transforming subjective experience.
That's incredible. So thinking about all this, what modern narratives function like these myths today? I mean, big Hollywood movies, political rhetoric, even advertising. Are they using myth themes to help us handle our contemporary contradictions?
It certainly seems plausible, doesn't it?
So, okay, what does this all really mean for us today? Let's try to boil down the core insights and why they still matter to you listening right now.
Well, I think one absolutely key theme is the primacy of structure over the individual elements. Levi Strauss really teaches us that meaning isn't just inherent in things themselves, a single custom, a word, a person. It comes from the whole system of relationships and oppositions they're part of.
Right, the chess piece analogy you mentioned.
Exactly. Its value isn't in the piece itself, but its position and relationship to all the other pieces and the rules. So to understand culture, you have to study these relational systems, these structures.
And crucially, these cultural structures are often unconscious, right? People live by these rules, they perform rituals, tell stories, but they aren't necessarily consciously aware of the deep underlying logic.
That's right. It's like grammar. We use it perfectly well most of the time without thinking about syntax rules. Levi Strauss saw the anthropologist's job as making these unconscious structures explicit, revealing that hidden architecture of human thought.
Which leads to another huge point.
The universality of the human mind, yes. Despite all the incredible cultural diversity we see, Levi Strauss argued really strongly for a psychic unity of humankind. He believed the same fundamental logical structures operate in everyone's mind, whether you're in the Amazon rainforest, ancient Greece, or modern London.
That's a powerful idea against ethnocentrism, isn't it? Judging others as primitive.
A very powerful antidote. It reminds us of our shared mental architecture, fostering a deeper sense of commonality beneath the surface differences.
Okay, so let's talk real-life applications. How can we use this structuralist lens? You mentioned understanding cross-cultural dynamics.
Yes, instead of just judging a custom from another culture as illogical or weird, we can ask, okay, what underlying binary opposition might this practice be trying to manage or resolve?
Like different attitudes towards food or hygiene or death.
Exactly. They might be different ways of structuring that fundamental nature-culture relationship or purity pollution. Shifting perspective like this can build real empathy. You start appreciating the internal logic of a system, even if it's not your own.
That makes a lot of sense. And you also suggested it applies to analyzing marketing, branding, maybe even politics.
Oh, definitely. Brands often define themselves by opposition, right? What they aren't. Think Apple Creative, simple, often positioned against the perceived complexity of PCs, corporate, functional.
Us versus them.
Precisely. And political campaigns do this constantly, simplifying complex issues into these compelling us versus them narratives. They're crafting modern myths that resonate by tapping into fundamental oppositions.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding this makes you a much more critical consumer of information. You start seeing the structural arguments underneath.
And we could even use this to deconstruct media and entertainment, couldn't we? Applying that myth theme analysis to movies.
Absolutely. Take something huge like Star Wars.
Mm.
You could easily see it as mediating oppositions like technology versus nature, the Death Star versus a force, or maybe order versus chaos, destiny versus free will, the empire versus the rebellion.
Reveals the hidden cultural work entertainment is doing.
Exactly. It shows us the anxieties and paradoxes our society is grappling with, often unconsciously.
And you also mentioned improving problem solving and innovation through bricolage.
Right, bricolage. Think of a bricoleur like a handyman, a tinkerer, someone who creatively reuses and recombines whatever tools and materials are already available rather than always needing something new. MacGyver is the ultimate pop culture bricoleur.
Uh-huh, right.
So in business, maybe it's seeing an old technology in a new way or repurposing parts from a failed project. But beyond that, thinking about binary oppositions gives you a direct innovation strategy.
How so?
Take a product. What are its core oppositions? Expensive, cheap, fast, slow, simple, complex. Now, try intentionally reversing one. What if slow became a desirable luxury feature? Or try collapsing an opposition. Can we make something both fast and high quality? When everyone assumes it's one or the other, it forces you to think differently.
That's a really practical way to use it. This structuralist lens really does offer a fresh angle on so much. So for you listening, how might you apply this way of thinking? To maybe understand a family dynamic or a confusing news story or even just a disagreement at work, it really gives you a new tool, doesn't it? So to wrap up our deep dive today, Claude Lévi-Strauss's structural anthropology basically reveals that there's this profound hidden order beneath all the apparent chaos of human social life. It gives us a powerful method for seeing the world not just as isolated facts, but as this vast interconnected web of structured relationships, like a language with its own grammar.
Yeah, and the lasting insight is just huge. It points to a shared human inheritance, a common mental architecture. That savage mind he talked about isn't primitive. It's the deep structural foundation of our own minds, too. An untamed way of thinking that still exists alongside science and modernity.
So it shifts the focus.
Completely. From just describing cultural differences to really understanding the universal principles, the underlying logic that makes us all human and binds us together across all our amazing diversity.
So as you go about your day, here's a final provocative thought to chew on. What unconscious grammars are shaping your beliefs right now, your social interactions, even how you understand the news? And how might consciously acknowledging them actually change your perspective or maybe even your actions? We definitely encourage you to explore Claude Lévi-Strauss's work further. His insights are, well, truly game-changing. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.